Welcome, folks, to episode 3609 of the Survival Podcast. Today we're going to talk about, I'm calling it the coming underground meat industry, or, I don't really know that that's actually the best terminology for it, because coming indicates that we're not already at a place where this exists, and it already does exist. When I say coming, I mean that this is going to become more and more and more of a thing, and more people are going to participate in it. And what I want to talk about out of the gate here before we talk about our sponsors for today is that this show is not only for people who want to go out and be a, let's say, producer on this side to grow chickens or quail or something else like that. This is for everybody in this audience, because I believe that everybody in this audience is affected by the things that we're going to talk about today. I'm not going to really get into how to do this from a standpoint of here's how to take care of chickens, raise chickens, make meat chickens, process chickens, and sell chickens. I want to talk about this more from the macro into what's driving it. What is making people go into the gray, or even in some cases the black market, to buy food when, there's a grocery store probably not far from most people. Yeah. I want to talk about the correlation between what's going on today, though, in the meat industry and what our grandparents or great grandparents went through during Prohibition, and the lessons we can learn from what they did as black marketeers, both as consumers and on the production side back in those 10 years of total lunacy and stupidity in this country. The friends and family model that drug dealers use. It works when you're dealing, something equally dangerous to methamphetamine, according to some bureaucrats, like raw milk, right? Like, we're going to talk about all that today. Even though I'm talking about the meat industry, what I'm really talking about is the animal product industry. So that includes meat, obviously, but also things like eggs and milk and any other animal products or value-added products thereof. And but I want to deeply dive into what's driving this. And I want to lead off actually reading you a DM that I got last night from someone we'll just call Josh. I don't want to put his full name on the air. He may not want that. But he did say it was okay with me reading his DM to me. Recently, I did an episode, 3602, I believe. Let me see. Yeah, he says 3602. And I mentioned underground meat production in that. This was my prediction episode that I did right when I came back about what to expect in the coming year. And this is what Josh said. My wife and I have been raising meat chickens, Salatin style, for our own use for the past couple of years. I thought I'd ask some close friends and family if they wanted to purchase some from us this year. I thought maybe we'd do up to 50% more, perhaps double what we'd already been doing. Every single one said yes, and most didn't give a shit about our price. Now we're planning on having 5X our production this year. It's a lot of work, but we're really excited. Thank you for your work with TSP. Without it, I wouldn't have started this or even lived in a place where it was possible. And in 6 months, some old ladies at the church in the middle of St. Paul are going to be eating my chicken. These people would never listen to TSP because Jack says fucking retard on the internet, but your work is making their lives better anyway. And that's, I do want to talk to you guys about it from the standpoint of, even if you're never going to raise a chicken or a quail, or maybe you're going to have a little egg flock of chickens, but where you live or just what you want in your life doesn't actually, make it where you want to raise your own animals for production for yourself, and certainly then you wouldn't want to do it for others, this show's still for you, because you have to eat too. And the reality is that people like meat. For all of the talk of plant-based this and plant-based that, people actually mostly, not all, but mostly in this country, turn to plant-based diets for one reason. Money, actually two reasons, money and convenience. It's pretty convenient when your kid wants breakfast and you got to get them off to school, instead of frying up some bacon and eggs or something like that, to take a waffle or a pancake out of the freezer, stick it in the toaster, push it down. When it pops up, dump some syrup on it that's made from corn, okay, and go, here, and they eat it. It's pretty convenient. It's pretty convenient to throw shit like a granola bar or whatever. And it's pretty cheap to make the foundational calories in your dinner, you know, a little piece of chicken or something and a bunch of like vegetables and potatoes or rice or something like that. So there's a cost issue and there is a convenience issue. And then there is a lack of product issue if you want to go outside the mainstream. That's what we're talking about today. So some of you may be like, look, I'm not going to do this. Okay, great. I never said you had to. But also some of you are like, but if somebody around me was making it available, I would buy it. And some of you know people who actually produce their own food. If you went to them and said, hey, man, you know, I understand you do tractor chickens. I would buy, you know, 20 a year off of you if you wanted to sell some. And you just might find the person that's never even considered it going, well, how much would you pay? And if you tell that person $5 a chicken, they're going to tell you to F off sideways down the road because you can't raise a chicken for $5. But if you said, you know, for a pasture raised chicken, 5-ish pounds, $4 a pound, $20, they might be like, hold on, let me check this. Maybe I can make this happen for you. And if you can go out then and maybe talk to a few friends for them and say, hey, I know this dude, and he could, if we were going to put in an order for 100 birds with a 50% deposit, raise us 100 birds every year, and all of us take 20, all five of us take 20, we would have these fresh produced local, they might be in on it. So I think there's room on both sides here. In fact, we need both sides for this model to work. And I think the demand far outstretches the supply. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. With that, let's go ahead and recognize our two sponsors of the day today. Sponsored today, number one today is Above Phone. How about you replace big tech with your own private ecosystems? You can have your own private device on top of having your own private device that runs an operating system that doesn't spy on you. So your device maker doesn't spy on you. You can stop the app makers from spying on you and even the carriers from spying on you. But Jack, I got this one app, man, and I can only get in Google Play, and it's not in the private thing, and I have to use it because insert reason here. Great. So you make a little jail, and you put that app in that little jail, and it only gets to do its evil little things on the back end process when you open the jail and give it visitation rights. And when you're done using it, you lock it right back in the jail and say, now you got to go away. I don't know if I'll be able to do all this. Well, here's the good news. You go over to Above Phone. You pick out your phone, you order, they send it to you. It comes with a one-hour consultation where an Above Phone expert will walk you through how to use and switch over to your new phone. There is no reason not to do this other than I don't have the money right now or I don't want to. Both of those are fine reasons, but there's not a technological hurdle and there's not a functionality hurdle. Go ahead and check out what's available at Above Phone. And remember, they're a great supporter of the MSB as well, offering you as an MSB member $75 off any phone at AbovePhone.com. Next up today, the Wealth Steading Podcast. If you want more money, you got to be smart with the money that you're earning that you're not spending. So rule one, earn more. Rule two, save more. Rule three, do something good with the money that you don't spend. And you want to know how to invest your money, then you want to check out the Wealth Steading Podcast with John Pugliano. He is an awesome wealth manager, investment manager. He's been doing it now for about a decade and a half. He made himself into a liquid millionaire before he managed a penny of anybody else's money. I first met John in Salt Lake City in 2010. He was just about to launch his wealth management service. He told me a little bit about it. He's been working with us on and off ever since. And pretty much for the last 10 years, I'm going to say, he's been working with us full bore all the time. Member of the expert council. He's a prepper as well as an investment manager. He's not just a money guy. This dude is a ham radio operator, has the backyard gardens, has the, you know, prep stored up and everything else. Really great guy. Just a wonderful man overall. Somebody I'm very happy to call my friend, John Pugliano. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and jump on into it today. And I want to, again, I want to talk to you just about kind of like what's actually driving this whole thing. It's going to be a very conversational show, not a nuts and bolts exactly how to. So I want to start off with something I was asked about yesterday, the flag. And people ask me about the flag that's behind me in most of my live streams. Again, it's the agorist flag. And the top of the flag is gray. The bottom is black. And they're separated by a 45-degree angle connecting the two corners of the flag. That is the intersection, the interactive edge between what we consider a gray market and a black market. I would say that everything that we're talking about today goes to the top of the flag. It's gray market. What makes something gray market? It means that maybe you shouldn't be selling it, but the product itself is not illegal. So I'm going to talk about our ancestors during Prohibition in a moment. That was black market. Alcohol itself was illegal in the United States for 10 years. And it was actually illegal in a lot of states or a lot of areas within states for longer than that, prior to it, leading up to it. And so they had to operate in the black market, meaning the selling act was illegal, but the possession act was also illegal. So today, an example of that would be something, yeah, you know, if you're doing drugs, if you're selling meth, you're now in the black market. But in some places, you know, if you had cannabis product and you were selling that, it's more the gray market. The act of the exchange is what violates the Department of Making You Sad, the government, but the ownership of the product doesn't. And this makes things a little bit more doable without going to jail. And we'll talk about not going to jail doing some of the things we're going to talk about today very, very soon. And by the way, I don't think anything that we're going to talk about doing today should be illegal. None of it should. I think that anybody that says that these things are inherently dangerous or whatever is a human who is either a lying piece of crap who carries water for the big food industry and the big pharmaceutical industries and for government as a whole that wants to restrict the rights of individuals, or they're an ignorant person either due to willful ignorance or due to they just don't know. Like these people that actually think like it's dangerous for you to buy an egg from the old lady that lives across the street from you and eat that egg, but it's totally safe for you to eat highly processed foods that come from Burger King. That person is just either willfully ignorant or just, I guess, situationally ignorant. And there's a lot more people out there like that, right? There's a lot more people out there like that than you would think. It's amazing to me sometimes when I see posts on social media about these issues, some of the defenders of the system, and you can tell they're not shills, right? And they're not, I guess you would call, basically unreasonable people. They literally believe it's dangerous because they're the same people that the second they were told by the TV to put a mask on, they wore a mask everywhere. They're the people that drove in their cars with their mask on by themselves. Right. And they're not necessarily stupid, but they are highly ignorant to reality. They don't have enough intellectual curiosity to seek it. And they're naturally trusting people of authority. That's why a lot of boomers are so compliant with it. It's amazing to me how compliant the boomers have become. It really is. It's like somewhere just as the silent generation was tagging out, they transferred this faith in government that the boomers notoriously didn't have. I mean, the boomers were the flower children. The boomers were the hippies. What happened, guys? I don't know. Anyway, let's go on from there. Just understand, gray market is some part of it is technically not legal, but the product itself probably is. So raw milk in of itself, like you are not going to see anybody arrested because they had a quart of raw milk in their possession. But you might see somebody arrested for selling the quart of raw milk to somebody else. That's gray market. Let's talk about how our grandparents and great-grandparents used black markets, because that eventually evolved into gray market too. So at one point in this country, I'm just going to say it, and I know some women are going to be mad at me, we let women vote, and that is directly what led to Prohibition. If you had not had women become eligible voters, there would have never been a Prohibition. There were men that supported it. There was nowhere near enough women to override the men, but the majority of men would have never went along with Prohibition. There was this whole temperance movement and trying to make less violence, and I want my husband to stay home and not go to the bar, and that was parlayed into Prohibition. That's how it was sold. It was women that drove it. If you're a woman and you would have not have done it at the time, that's fine for you to say, but you don't know what you would have done at the time. You were born into now, not then. And anybody that tells you women didn't drive the Prohibition movement is a liar or willfully ignorant, because it's really easy to find out. It's really easy to research, you know. So anyway, That's what happened. And a lot of people went, no, I'm not gonna allow this to happen. And so they built little homemade stills and all. My grandfather had one. The main body of the still, the part you would heat up to move the fluid into the condenser, was probably about 15 gallons. It looked like a wash tub, basically, that was built out. I really wish I had this thing. There was the worm or the screw, call it what you want, was built out of a bucket, and then it had copper tubing going through it and what have you. There were clearly some pieces missing to it. I really wish when I moved down here to Texas I had taken it with me, but I had a $400 Mustang too. I didn't really have room for a lot of bulk, so I left it home, and God knows what happened. My dad's probably sold it for scrap or something by now. But that was done, and it was done with beer too. A lot of people were making beer during Prohibition, right? But if you wanted to stay small in volume, you made liquor. It was fast, it was reliable, and you could put a lot in a quart jar, a lot of value into one quart jar. So think about some of the things they did as we move into how to do this and not go to jail, okay? So they stayed small. They only went with the friends and family model. I asked my grandpa about this, and he said, yeah, we made shine, and we sold it to your uncles and your aunts and our cousins and our friends, right? So they didn't, like, put up a sign somewhere. They didn't have social media, but they didn't do the equivalent of social media of a time and put up a label and say, this is, you know, Andrew Spirico's shine, right? They just made it. And they weren't all running around in the woods with giant things like you see on artificial television, reality, fake TV, like the Moonshine Show and whatever. That's not what everybody was doing. Most people, like, they made shine down in the basement because no one was going to come there. No one was going to come there. And no one would have gotten there without being ratted out. Like, if the revenuers were on their way, the internet of the day went out. Hey, tell Biff what's up. Okay? Like that. And then they actually transitioned into gray markets for a while. When Prohibition went away and booze came back, there were a lot of people that were like, kind of like Biff's shine. Pretty good stuff. And, you know, compared to paying the man his tax bill on top of it, it's the same money or cheaper, and I think it's better. And I'd rather have Biff have my money than them revenuers. See, for a while it stuck in people's heads that a big part of what you were paying for when you bought a bottle of whiskey was going to the government. And the government was the one that took it away from you in the first place. And Biff or Biff's dad was the one that made it for you when you couldn't get it any other way. It wasn't really till World War II hit and so many of our men left that gray market really waned. And it's still around. There ain't a person out there that wants to know where to find shine that can't find shine right now. It's just that there's such an alcohol industry and it's become so cost efficient that there's not as much opportunity there as there used to be. But the people still doing it and not going to jail for it, what are they doing? They stay small. They only sell to friends and family. They do not advertise on Facebook. Yeah? Just think about that. Now, let's talk about the economics. Like, does it make sense to actually raise chickens or quail or sheep or pigs for money? And to do it on a small scale the way that we're talking about? Well, let's compare it to what's the old model. Before we had a shitload of housing regulations and homes, HOAs and stuff like Suburban Homestead Outfitters, kind of like the weed guy. Exactly like the weed guy. Let's hit on that for you 80s characters, right? You guys that were teenagers or early 20s in the 80s like me, right? We all knew someone to get weed from. And usually the guy that we knew was the guy that knew somebody that actually was like growing the weed in a closet or getting it from somebody else. And that guy did not have a sign, Bill's Weed, on his house, but everybody knew how to get Bill's weed. And people knew that this weed, even if they got it from Tommy, was Bill's weed, right? They had local brands even, right? We all had this in our background if we were people that were predisposed to this. And most of these people did not really worry about law enforcement. I'm not saying that they didn't know it was there and that they were stupid about it. I'm saying the way that they acted, they knew they were probably never going to hear nothing from anybody. because they did the same thing that our grandparents did with their booze business. They stayed small. If somebody would have came to them and said, I'm looking for like a kilo, they would have said, get the fuck out of here. They would have like, you're an idiot or a fed or both, and I don't want nothing to do with it. They would have never been caught with enough to do serious time. People that get greedy, right? You know, pigs get fed. What happens to hogs? So, yeah, just keep that in mind. Now, let's move from there. The economics I was getting at, the old way that people who were like, you know, I need a little bit more money to get by than I used to. One of the common things people would do if you had a bigger house, especially if you'd gotten to the point where maybe some of the kids had gone off and gotten jobs or gone to college or joined the military or whatever, you had an empty room, you rented the room out. Now, I don't know what people are paying to rent a room right now. And I'm sure there's some extreme examples of this, like what you would pay to rent a room in San Francisco or Seattle. And those people might be paying $1,200 to rent a room about the size of the one that I'm sitting in. Yeah, you know, and that's $12,000 plus another to $14,400 a year. That's a lot of chickens. That's a lot of chickens to make $14,000 in profit a year. But I'm going to say that in most places, you can probably rent a room for about $300 a month. And, you know, plus expenses. So you might have some share of the electrical or whatever, but a base rate of $300 to $400. So $3,600 to $4,800 a year. That's not that big of a bogey to hit. And there's a lot of places where it's kind of hard to rent a room or people don't want to do it. I'll tell you what, I don't want to rent a room. I don't want another person living in my house. You know, if it's my son or something that came on hard times or even the whole damn family, that's different. But like some random person that answers an ad on Craigslist, even if I do a background check and he's not a criminal, I really don't want somebody else in my home. It's very disruptive. Unless you have like a self-contained in-law suite with a back entrance where you never have to see the person, it's a disruption. They're going to do laundry in your laundry room, right? They're going to be using the shower when you want to take a shower. Like they're, even if they have their own bathroom, maybe it's a pressure issue. You get what I'm saying? Like, in a lot of ways, having like a little side business that can make you $4,000 or $5,000 in profit a year is much better than renting a room to somebody from a lifestyle equivalent. And if you're doing this for others, you're probably doing it for yourself. So you're getting top quality food for yourself. And at that point, it's probably, if you're doing this right, it's going to be free, right? It's not going to be free. Or it's going to be free for you because you're selling enough to make enough money that your portion you're eating isn't costing you anything. Hopefully there's some money left over, right? And there's an argument about plant-based versus protein. Listen, this show today is about animal protein. If you don't like it, saw it off, okay? I'm not going to say you can't get protein from plants because you can. And I'm not going to say if you don't carefully combine proteins from plants, you can't get all the amino acids you need because you can. It takes work, but that's not what we're talking about today. And if we have somebody here that's a burnt in the ass little vegan or something, I will get rid of you if you become disruptive. I'm not saying you are yet. I'm just warning you because if it happens, I'm not even going to say anything. You're just going to disappear. So keep that in mind as you talk to each other. And if plant protein's your deal, guess what? There's tons of creators on YouTube for you. It's not going to help. You're not going to get it here. We're going to talk a little bit about eating plants today and how to incorporate that into your revenue model. But you're not going to hear about trying to get all your protein from plants here because it's a really stupid way to do things, just to be honest. But you do what you want to do. Anyway, what's driving the dynamic, though? What's driving the dynamic of making this opportunity become available to people? First and foremost is inflation and sheer cost. The cost of meat in particular, especially quality meat at any level, has skyrocketed. The shittiest ground beef right now is selling for more than you could have gone out and bought a butcher's cut like a chuck eye 5 years ago. I'm like, you know, I don't hate fat, but most of the like pre-ground 80-20 that you buy in a store is more like 80, you know, 75-25. And it's, you can just look at it when you cook it and you can see that it's not high quality meat. And that's the cheapest shit you can buy. Now, if you're buying that, I already think you're making a mistake. And let me explain to you what you should be doing. Recently, we had a cold weekend. My wife loves really soft, slow-cooked meat. And I didn't have a big hunk of something in the freezer. Mostly I have steaks and chops and stuff like that. So I went to the store and I bought a brisket. And I cut it up and I cooked it like you'd cook meat for stew. And it was delicious. She loved it. There was, for my vegetarian friends, there was some vegetables in there. I made a mirepoix, you know, celery, carrot, and onion as the base. And then there was some bay leaf in there and some pepper, and that's technically a plant. But it was most, and there actually was some tomato in the base of that as well. But mostly it was just stewed meat. Now, why would I do that? Why would I take a big, beautiful brisket that I could have thrown on the grill and smoked? Well, first of all, it was a trim brisket. So it was, you know, a good fat ratio to the meat for doing that way, but it wasn't like half of it was fat. It was $4 a pound. It was $4 a pound. And your cheap cut, like bottom round, was like $7. And chuck shoulder, like shoulder chuck, was like $8. So I just bought the least expensive, best quality. Well, what you pay for ground beef today, you can go out and buy that brisket, throw it through a grinder, and you're ahead. So if you can do that and save money, then there's money to be made by a producer that can fill the gap, because that's how ridiculous. But price is driving this. Don't care if you're vegan, dude. If you're going to be here to argue, I'm going to get rid of you. That's your last warning. You can say your piece. You can talk about it. But what you're talking about is not what we're talking about today. And if you want to be argumentative, you'll go away. That's one final warning before you go bye-bye. Anyway, it's like the people, yeah, just to be clear on this, I'm not being a dick, but when I do a show on Bitcoin and somebody wants to show up and talk about Ripple, I get rid of them because that's all we're talking about. We're not talking about your little pet issue today, bro. And usually anybody's title is like initials, they're special. Maybe you're not. I'll give you a chance. Let's see. All right. Next is a real desire for quality and rising awareness of ChemAg's problems. Okay. There is a lot of people that are more aware now of the things like seed oils, for instance. And that already is going to push you to animal product, right? And Carson, if he was just answering a question, then he shouldn't be upset by anything I said. All right? Shouldn't be upset. Because my warning doesn't apply. Because I don't know. I can't stay watching you guys there the entire time because I get distracted like right now. So I'm just issuing a basic understanding to everybody in chat. Maybe I should just start out with that. And that way I don't have to worry about anybody's feelings. And when somebody goes off like that, then I just get rid of them. And if you get got, you get got. Anyway, so people are really aware of the problems with ChemAg. They want higher quality meat. They want higher quality animal products. And things like chicken fat or schmaltz is an animal product. Any chicken that I cook that has skin or any additional fat, especially if I do like a whole bird, I always harvest the fat, melt it down, strain it through a little sieve, put it in a jar, label what it is, and stick it in the refrigerator, and I cook with it. Beef, I do the same thing. Pork fat, I do the same thing. All three of those I harvest. So there's people that are looking for high quality animal product that want better quality. They also want more ethically treated animals. I will pick on vegans, but I will say when they start making an argument about the way that animals are treated in a CAFO, I completely agree with that. The solution though isn't to not eat animals. The solution then becomes to buy animals that are raised ethically. Okay. And when you can go to the place the animal is raised, you can see exactly how it's raised. Next would be, there is a lack of fairly priced alternatives in the regulation-driven existing market. And what I mean by that is, you can go buy beef that is probably truly free-range grass-fed beef at the grocery store. I say probably because I don't trust any of these people. I really don't trust them to actually do what their label says. And there's a lot of labels that don't mean anything. But if you have 100% grass-fed on a label, that means that animal legally cannot have been fed grain. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, but legally, no. Okay? But even when you do that, you get into this, like, the stuff's already super expensive. And this is now more expensive to what you already could afford. And then it's going to be a very limited quantity. My grocery store, the grass-fed beef section, you know, I could probably take everything they have on display and put it in one igloo cooler that I could carry to my truck at any given time. There's just not that much of it there. If you're looking at lamb in a grocery store, that's one of the places you're probably looking at 100% grass-fed animal. There's not really a lot of lamb CAFOs. But in general, people just want higher quality, and they can't find what they're looking for, including people doing what we're talking about today. There's not a lot of there. Now, Jesse right now is saying has a big Mennonite population with a lot of cottage goods available. And if you live in a place like that, there's probably a lot of options. You would be shocked at how many places you think of as out in the country. There is no place to buy this stuff because people are afraid of the consequences of getting caught, or people don't know that the market's there for what they do. There's people that aren't doing it because there's so many hurdles in the way. So the person who gets creative and builds the market before the production can be very, very successful. There's also not really as many hurdles as people think. This is actually a pretty easy thing to do. If you want to start raising quail for meat and eggs, once you get your first birds, if you got them as little tiny baby chicks the size of a friggin' golf ball, you're 6 to 7 weeks from having eggs. In another 6 to 7 weeks, you could have your first hatching. You have your first culls. You have the first meat. All you need is somebody who wants to buy your product. Quail eggs and quail sell at a premium even in the conventional market. It's not as hard as you think, and there are people waiting for it. So that's driving this movement. That's driving email or messages like I read from Josh at the beginning about how when they decided, hey, we figured out how to raise chickens for ourselves. Let me go ask a few of my buddies I drink beer with and shit and work with. And everybody said yes. So the fact that there's a willing counterparty to the producer, there's a willing consumer, is driving this movement as well. Next is we need to talk about how to stay out of jail. We really do. If you do the things I'm going to say, I'm not going to promise you that you're not risking any jail time at all. I have no idea where you live. I have no idea of your ability to actually understand what I'm saying. I have no idea of your ability to be smart about what you do and who you talk to. I can't guarantee shit, but I'm going to tell you that there are basically five primary things you can do, and you're highly unlikely to end up going to jail. The worst you're likely to end up with is a fine. And I'm going to tell you something that good gray market producers have always done. They build the cost of failure into the model. So let's talk about a completely different thing. And there's a lot of dynamics in this have changed because of like Uber and Lyft as disruptors to the marketplace. But it used to be that there was, and there's still a lot of regulation. It's very like Uber and Lyft do not operate the way they do in, let's say, Dallas in New York City. So New York City still has some of this going on. There's something called a medallion, a cab medallion, which basically says you can operate a cab in New York City. Not you can go get a job driving a cab working for somebody else as a medallion for the cab. But you are like it is a big deal to be a New York City cab driver with a medallion. They sell for upwards of $1 million or more. So there's a lot of people that went out and drove unmedallioned cabs. And if they got a fine for $30,000, they said, fuck it. I make way more than that, and it's way cheaper than $1 million for a medallion. Does that mean you should go do that? No, I'm just saying they've built risk into their price model. Yeah? And so if you were to get a fine for a few $100 in a year that you made a few $1,000s, it's the cost of doing business, and then maybe you need to think about what you're doing going forward. So there's always a risk-reward model to look at with this. And I'm not advocating go out and break the law for the purpose of breaking the law here. I'm saying in a lot of places, if you do this right, you're not doing anything illegal anyway. Like learn your local laws and stay as close as you can inside those. And, you know, like, Think of like skirting those edges like a little kid that's not quite good at coloring yet. Maybe there's a place or two where you stray out, but, you know, plausible deniability, et cetera. Usually the department of making you sad is going to show up and say you have to stop doing this. And what you say is, yes, sir, no matter what you're going to do, right? You figure out what you want to do next. But here's what I would tell you will make you less likely to end up on the wrong side of the law here. First and foremost, start out doing it for yourself. You're going to surface any, you know, Karens that live in your neighborhood that are going to make any trouble for you just by doing this at all. If you're only doing it for yourself, odds are it's going to be completely legal for you to do it. Especially if you look, don't ask permission, but look up local codes and regulations and try to stay in those and do it for yourself. What will likely happen is you will surface any Karens or Kyles who will call the Department of Making You Sad. The Department of Making You Sad will come see you. They'll look at what you're doing. You'll tell them what you're doing. You tell them to tell Go Karen to piss up a rope, and they probably will. Now, sometimes when you get a person like that in some cities and townships, code enforcement is a very broad thing. And their code enforcement is animals. It's if your fence is leaning too much or whatever. So have your shit straight. But what will happen is either nothing, great, or Karen or Kyle makes a call to department. Department of Making You Sad comes out. Department of Making You Sad goes, Mr. Spearco, nothing you're doing is illegal or wrong here. I'm sorry to have bothered you. And they go away. And Karen shuts up. And then you also have a pretty good idea who the Karen is and who to avoid going forward. It's also a business model decision. You need to see if you can do this proficiently, establish your system, make it profitable in that I am comfortable with what I spend in time and money to make this chicken, this quail, this rabbit, whatever for myself, and then eat it and consider myself ahead. If you can't do that for you, you're not going to be able to justify charging more for the output to your friends and family. So establish that first, right? Confidential informants over meat is wild. Yeah, I agree, man. Then the next is stay small. Now, small's a relative number, right? So if I'm living in a place where I can legally grow and process tractor chicken and sell that to my friends and family, and I have an exemption in my state where I can do 2,000 birds a year, 1,500 is a lot more than most people are going to want to do. So you don't even have to worry about enforcement there. I'm not saying to just look for the gray market or the black market here. I'm saying try to stay legal if you can, but think about the fact that you don't necessarily have to be to get away with it, okay? And that there's a lot of people out there willing to buy what you have, and in most places you probably can do it all legally anyway. It's just you would like to not even have to interact with the state if you don't have to. And then when you are selling to other people, now the bureaucratic mind starts going and the inspector, code enforcer, whatever is looking for more shit. And if you look at anybody hard enough, you can come up with something to cite them for. So you want to keep them away. By staying small relative to your situation, you're probably going to do that. My granddaddy and his daddy, when they were making shine during Prohibition, if somebody would have came and said, hey, I want 100 cases, they would have told them to go piss off, even if they knew them. They would have said, that's not what we do. This is extra money. This is I'm selling to my friends and family, and I'm doing it because I make some pocket money, but I want them to have the product at the same time. Like, if you're doing that, you're running it over somewhere else, and this invites all kinds of problems. So stay small. Next, again, the friends and family model. The friends and family model. One of my uncles was a big time pot dealer. He was the weed guy. And this, he did this. And I'm telling you, local PD knew it. He had two rules. I don't sell to you if I don't know you. And I don't sell to kids. And I don't sell to anybody that I know would resell to kids. No one ever bothered him. And that was something full on black market. This is not today where a lot of places cannabis is in the gray part of the field where the possession's not illegal, but the sale is, unless you're in a regulatory environment or whatever, and then you can do it. It's a protectionist racket, is what I think. This was full on, anytime they could have just got a warrant, kicked his door down, went in there, and got him with enough to give him 6 months of jail time, and no one ever did shit. No one ever did anything. And so I'm not saying that no one will bother you, but I'm saying when you stick to friends and family, you have a lot less propensity to have somebody complain. When you stick to friends and family, if the person bought a dozen eggs from you and two of them were bad, they come back and you say, hey, man, I had two bad eggs. You go, dude, next dozen, there's an extra two. I got you. I'm sorry. They don't like, oh, I'm going to call somebody. Now, remember, we live in a society where people have literally called 911 for shit like McDonald's ran out of nuggets. If you have a friend or family member that's that person, you probably know to exclude them from your market. Okay? Not nastily either, because then they'll do it just to fuck with you, right? You know your own family better than me. You know how to handle that. The next is status jujitsu. If you do start to get bigger, if you do want to start expanding, if you want to start maybe incorporating other producers so that you can sell more product without doing more real work on building the product itself, then you need to look at things like food clubs and membership programs and things like that, food churches, etc. And you need to figure out with an attorney how that fits into your model if you go that large. Up until you get big enough, I wouldn't even worry about that. I would just try to stand under whatever cottage food laws your area has. And then think about it. Like, there are states where raw milk, there's a ton of loopholes. There's states where it's really hard. You know, pick your battles. If raw milk's really hard to sell, but you can sell all the quail you want, build your business on quail. And then stick to cash. Stick to cash. I asked ChatGPT in prep for this episode, what is the number one way that moonshiners during Prohibition avoid getting caught? And it said no paper trail. There wasn't a shiner back in the 20s that would have sold you some shine for a check, right? Certainly, I don't even think they had credit cards yet, but you got it. But nobody was dealing pot, right? Hey, man, how much? $25. Can I write you a check? Do you take credit card? No! Cash money. Yeah, cash money, barter, Bitcoin. Stick to that. You probably aren't going to have any trouble. Somebody says, Aaron says pet milk, right? Yeah, that's one way to sell raw milk, but it doesn't work everywhere. If you're going to do things like that, label it as something else. Make sure what you're doing is bulletproof, and then don't stick it in their face. You know, don't become an activist against the government unless that's your full-time plan. There were people back when you couldn't own gold that did things like posted a picture of themselves holding a bar of gold and saying, I dare you to come arrest me. Most of them didn't get arrested. Some of them did. Right? If you're going to go that route, it's a different thing than we're talking about today. This is stay under the radar, even if you're legal. Just don't invite, right? Don't invite the vampire in. Have you ever thought about this? You ever study vampire lore, right? Or some of the vampire pop culture shows? I had one I really loved. I even still like to watch it now as a guilty pleasure. Buffy the Vampire Slayer. What can I say? I was in my 20s in the 90s when that show was on, and it was entertaining for a variety of reasons. But one of the things is what? The vampire can't come into your house without being invited in. Or there has to be some sort of magic incantation, and then the vampire can get in. And if that happens, then you need some new incantation to push the vampire out and not let him in the house anymore, right? I know this from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you know? Somebody says they love the movie. I'm talking about the series with Sarah Michelle Gellar, not the movie that series came from. Anyway, when like a cop or an FBI agent or something, can we come in? No, you can't come in, right? Think about that with this model. Not necessarily a search warrant required to get in the home, but let's not invite the vampires in. Let's stick to a model that keeps those people away, even if we're not doing anything wrong. Yeah? Okay. And then remember, I won't say any more about this part of it, but remember, how did they get the biggest mobster ever, the biggest gangster ever, Al Capone? Taxes. Just keep that in one's mind there. All right. Now, the economics of making it work. I think to make this work in a way that really makes you enough money to make it worth doing, start out with one product, one thing, get really good at it, and build a market with it. This, by the way, I don't care if you're doing this completely above board, inspected facility, that is a good plan anyway. You're going to have an emulation of Joel Salton's farm, right? You're going to sell, like, Joel Salton's very public. Everything he does is very public. It's not under the radar. And he still kind of recommends that you start out under the radar, right? Tracker some chickens, learn how to do it, process them, eat them, give a few away, friends and family model. So even Joel recommends that starting point. And there's a reason, because it works. It lets you perfect your skill set, perfect your infrastructure. You're processing all of it before you take any real risk. John's asking if quail are noisy. No, they're not. They're not. And if you have a question, make sure you put question in all caps, right? Question in all caps, and we'll star you for the end. I only got one good eye, and I've got a lot of things going on. And so, again, if you want to ask questions, you should be putting that question in all caps. If you don't do that, I may not see it. But start out with one, but don't stay that way. If I really wanted to make money off my operation, we have built a pretty good book of business, even with a downsized duck flock. But when we were thinking about ramping it up, we started playing with microgreens and stuff. We started having add-on products. Whenever you check out on anybody's website that sells more than one thing anyway, you probably, because built right into shopping carts and things like that, are customers who bought this also bought this. You know, the product that makes John Willis at SOE Tactical Gear the most money, now, not necessarily the most top-line money, but the highest profit of any product that he sells. Now, this guy sells chest rigs and tactical gear, belts, bags, all that shit, right, to war fighters all over the world, to law enforcement organizations. My, I guess you'd call him my nephew-in-law, my niece's husband is a sheriff's deputy in Colorado, detached to an FBI task force, and that task force just bought a shitload of stuff from John. Small world, right? But the thing that makes John the most money is fucking gummy bears. When anybody's checking out, hey, you want a bag, a pound of gummy bears? And think about it, he's selling like the deployed soldiers and shit. Hell yeah, I'll add a bag of gummy bears. He buys them by the pallet, and they turn them over really fast, and that way they're always fresh and delicious, right? Now, you see, Aaron said T-shirts, not T-shirts. Gummy bears, T-shirts. This is a great T-shirt I'm wearing today. Let me turn around and show it to you. You guys can buy this at the TSP Swag Shop. All right, I don't know how well of a view you got of it, tspswag.com. We don't make a lot of money on shirts. Ask Tom, he runs the shop. Shirts are not a high-profit item unless they're like Gordon Gartrell or something for another pop reference or something like that, right? They're low margin, but gummy bears are high margin. But all my point is that once you build a customer base and you say, I don't want to go big, I want my customer base small, the only way to grow revenue is what? Sell more to the customer base. But this is the business lesson today from someone that knows a little bit about business here, okay? That's how you always grow your business most efficiently. You sell a product really well, and you do add-on services. And even if you're building the market itself, you're also selling more to the same customer. It's just common business practice, and it makes sense. So that's the model you should be building. Once you determine a profit stream, then you have in front of you, like, I am raising chickens, and every year I am selling 200 chickens. And that makes me, let's say, $10 a bird, $2,000. Instead of trying to sell 100 more chickens, which is 33% more work, your job should be, before you even think about that, drive down the cost of production and drive up the efficiency of production. In other words, how do I cut my feed costs? How do I cut my labor costs? I don't have any labor costs. I do everything myself. You have a labor cost, your time. So instead of I'm paying somebody by the hour to do this work every day, it's I'm paying myself to do this work every day. That's what you're really doing, whether you know it or not, whether any money moves or not. So if you can reduce your work from 2 hours a day to 1 hour a day, you doubled your labor profit to yourself. So drive down costs, drive up efficiency, and lean it out until if I go any further, It's ridiculous, and I'm going to cut my quality and don't do that. So it might be as simple as when I started doing this, I was buying high-quality feed from the local feed store, and now I need to see if I can buy more feed, maybe from where the feed store is buying it, from a custom mill, and cut my feed cost in half. We did it. We did it. I got to go 90 miles to get it, but being able to buy feed that I can't even get, and the closest thing I can get is about $30 a bag now, and I get it for $13. Yeah, that's worth a trip 4 or 5 times a year. You see what I'm saying? Drive down the cost, drive up the efficiency, and then begin adding other products. Also know what you want. Do you want side money or full income for at least one family member? And sometimes full income for one family member isn't as much money as you would think. So if you have a stay-at-home family member who can do part of the business when you're not there because you have a 9-to-5 job, and maybe that means that you're working really hard on weekends with construction, building a new trickin' tractor, processing birds, making sure Dave is really going to show up and pick. But, you know, it's just that somebody needs to move the chicken tractor and make sure the food and water is full. And some other components in the business, like maybe you have a value-added product that you're doing, like a hot sauce or something like that. Got a little story for you on that in a minute. Then that person might make $20,000-$25,000 a year, and that's plenty for it to be a full-time income relative to that person. Because, again, it's all cash money. You do with that as you will, but they're not leaving the house. You don't have a child care bill. Maybe you want to be able to homeschool. And that doesn't necessarily mean you need to be a teacher as much as a guide, but you need to be home. You know, somebody wants to be the homemaker. That person may not need anywhere near the income that would justify them working a 9-to-5 job. And now somebody has to figure out what happens with the kids all day long, et cetera, who takes care of the house. But you need to know that. And there's no problem saying right now we don't want that. We're going to keep it small. And if it grows to the point where, look, hey, we could transition to this, but you need to like be clear at any given point. I'm either transitioning to this or I never plan to, or I don't plan to right now. That will make everything way more clear and you won't make dumb moves. Here's an example. I had a person in my life in the past who wanted to go into producing more chickens and wanted to invest in incubators and blah, 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 blah. But the plan they had was they didn't know what they had. I can hatch this many birds a week. Great, big fucking deal. What are you going to do with them? And how much can you sell them for? And how much does it cost? And what? And this person just could not grok, you know, asking me to tell them to go forward. And I'm like, you can't answer any of these questions. You have to have a solid model, a solid plan, a solid estimate of revenue. And this is why I recommend you do it for yourself, because your estimate on your production cost and time will be very accurate. If you've never done it and you think, I'm going to start raising chickens for other people, you have no fucking idea what you're doing. Go ahead, raise 50 chickens, take 20 for yourself, pick 6 people, give them all 5, right? Or, what you know, pick 12 people and give them all 2 and keep the balance. Dude, that's fine. But at that point, you're not trying to really do it for profit. You're just learning. You're doing the equivalent of you went to trade school, except you didn't have a teacher other than YouTube University. Yes, it's going to cost you money. That's okay. But be clear about what you're doing there. And be clear about where you're headed. That will make all your decision-making a lot better. Grow slowly and be creative with your offerings and let your market tell you what it wants. Don't be Apple. I showed my grandson what a fucking iPod Classic looks like yesterday because he had never seen one. And his brain was just like, you had to use that wheel to toggle through everything? Yeah, you did. Did everybody like it? And I'm like, no, everybody hated it. He's like, why did they do it? I said, they thought they knew better than their customers. And if you're Apple, with an emerging technology that hasn't been established, that's going to change and go away anyway, you can get away with it. If you decide, hey, I know what, I'm going to add quail to what I'm already doing, and you don't talk to your customers who are buying chicken eggs from you and chicken, they may not want it. You should say, hey, Bill, if I also had quail eggs, would you want any? And if you ask all your customers and all your customers say no, or only one says yes, and no one's willing to put down a deposit on anything, don't do that. Do something else. Your market will tell you what they want. I learned this in sales. I would talk to all my customers. Back when I was in, when I was used to sell hardware to carriers and OEMs and things like that. And all of my customers are like, we need a managed switch that's also NEB certified. And the company said, they don't need a managed switch. They just need a switch. And I said, no, the guy that I did $900,000 worth of business with last year said he's going to stop buying our fucking hubs and he's moving the switches and he needs a managed fucking switch. And the only competitive product in this space is from a company called, you've heard of it, Cisco. And if you don't fucking do that, we're going to lose that business. And they told me to sell around it. And the customer said, get fucked. That's not a big business. It applies more to friends and family. If all your friends say, we don't want fucking broccoli sprouts, don't go to microgreen broccoli sprouts. Right? Now, there's nothing wrong with if they don't really seem interested. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to grow some microgreen black oil sunflower with some microgreen daikon radish, and I'm going to make a blend out of that, maybe put one more thing in with it, and I'm just going to give everybody a free clamshell. And I'm just going to grow a little bit of it and see what happens ahead. That's marketing. That's the same thing as asking them what they want, except maybe since they've never experienced it, they don't know. But if they go home and they take that and they throw it on top of that omelet that they made with your eggs, and they like it, they'll say, can I get some more? Well, can I put you down for a clamshell a week at $5 a clamshell or whatever it is? That's asking your market too. But what your market will buy, that's what you should produce. This is Econ 101. And since your market is limited and you know your market because you're in a friends and family model, there's no reason not to ask them. And again, you can ask them as in, would you buy? Would you be interested in? Or you can sample to them, which is a great way to do. How many of us have bought things because of a sample? You know, if you're an 80s kid, how much fucking Hickory Farms did you eat at the mall? You ate all of it until they wouldn't let you have, like, you've been here five times, kid, get the fuck out of here, right? But, you know, I still buy shit from Hickory Farms today. It works, is all I'm saying. Next is consider packages, memberships, value-added products, and things like that as you expand inside that small captive marketplace. You can even get creative with, hey, let's say you have 20 regular customers. All right. Do you know what almost everybody in this country does every fall, right in that, to like the third or fourth week of November? They buy a fucking turkey. Turkeys are incredibly profitable. But you should ask, like, look, hey, I'm thinking about doing pastured turkey next year. You know when to ask that question if time works for you? About October. And I said, yeah, I've never thought. You know, why don't you go out and see what a pastured turkey costs and then look for one. And if they can find anybody doing it and they call them, they're going to be like, oh, man, you got to order them things like now for next year. And they're like $180. Did you know that these people want $180? You got to order them a year in advance. No, Bill, I didn't know that. But you know what I think I could do? I think I could probably raise turkey and sell them to you for $4 a pound and do one a year that's special, like if you'd be interested. And that means, you know, if that's a 30-pound bird, $4 a pound is $120. But turkeys are expensive. I'm going to need a deposit of $60 just like he'll need a deposit of $100. And all of a sudden, you're reasonable. Art of the deal from yesterday. But you didn't even make the ridiculous proposal. You just let him go see what the market would bear. And, now, don't use my numbers. Do the numbers that work for you. You know, and when I've done turkeys for meat, that's exactly what I had. $4 a pound, carcass weight, and I don't do any processing. I think I charged people a $50 deposit on them because I knew they would all be well over that. They come pick it up, they self-process or take it to a processor themselves, they weigh it, and on the honor system, they pay me the balance because I only sold to people that I knew through the show. Worked out perfectly. Worked out. And we didn't do a lot of it, but I'll tell you what we did is every year we did it, we put about 100 pounds of meat in our freezer. We would keep 3 to 4 birds for ourselves, and it cost us nothing. And it was the highest quality meat and the easiest. A turkey, bro, let me tell you how turkey works. If you don't kill it in the first 6 weeks and you don't let it kill itself in the first 6 weeks, unless a predator kills it, it is a Mack truck, it will not die. They have about 6 weeks of stupidity where poults attempt suicide on a regular basis. You get them through that and they're good to go. So consider packages, memberships, value-added products. You know, once you have a customer as a regular customer, see if you can put together a grouping of product that, let's say, every 2 weeks they buy. See if you can always train your customer. Train your customer. I don't care if it's your next-door neighbor that you've known for 20 years. You still train your customer to do business the way you want to do business. This is another econ business principle 101 that no one teaches. So how do we sell duck eggs is an example. We don't go anywhere. We don't deliver anything. You come here. You call my wife in advance. She says if we do or do not have product for you. You tell her how much you want when you're coming to get it, and you pick it up at the gate. If we're home, we'll bring it out to you. If we're not home, we'll leave it for you. If you steal from us, we'll never do business with you again. It's never been a problem in 10 years. What do I mean by that? Well, literally, so the person wants 4 dozen duck eggs. I think she's charging 10 bucks a dozen now, and we have no problem selling at that price. That person owes us 40 bucks. We'll put a cooler just inside the gate with the walk-through gate not locked. And we'll tell, you know, we're not going to be home. Dogs will be in the house. Don't worry about the signs. They'll open the gate. They open the thing. They take their eggs. They put the money in, and they stick something on top of it, and then they close the cooler, and when we call them, the money's there. Now, I'm not worried that somebody's listening to me on YouTube is going to run to my house and try to steal 20 or 30 bucks from me. I'm really not, and you wouldn't know when to do it anyway. I'm just saying we have that easy model because we have right on our website at 9mile.farm. how we do business. And if you don't want to do business that way, we do not sell to you. So that means I don't have to worry about transportation or anything like that. All I have to do is person come by, here's your eggs, here's your money. Should you do business that way? No, you should do business the way that works for you. I'm saying train your customer to do business the way you want to do business with your customer. And you are always training your customer. So when your customer says, if I buy 4 dozen this week, can I get a $5 discount? And you say yes, you just train that customer that you will discount your product. If you say no, you've just trained that customer, I will not discount my product because I know the value of what I have. Be careful what you do. If you say, yeah, I can bring it by the office for you today. If you work in the same office, if it's kosher at your office, if you're going there anyway and you don't mind doing it, great. But you have trained your customer now. Jack delivers to the office. That's an expectation you have created. Be careful. Don't do things that you don't want to do all the time, because the first time you do it, the customer will expect it forever. And the first time you cut your price, the customer will expect you to do it again, and not the same way. The customer will expect, well, if I got $5 off for 4 dozen, I should get $10 off for 8 dozen. It doesn't work that way. Never set a precedent you don't want to follow, okay? If you tell the customer you can pay me next week, you just train them and you extend credit. If you say, I only take cash, and they say, but will you take PayPal today? You've just trained them that you do not enforce your cash-only policy. Zelle or whatever, you've just trained them that you do business in a way you didn't want to do business. You don't need their business that bad, folks. But, you know, it's just as good as cash, then go get cash. We'll have to go to the bank. That's not my problem. You see? In this model. Now, if you are completely above board, you're operating under cottage food laws, and you want to take credit as a form of payment, if you want to take PayPal or Zelle or whatever, I don't have any problem with you doing it. Just don't do something you don't want to do only for the business of one person, because it will become a standard practice in your business and you'll be stuck with it. Okay, I just got another question there. I'm trying, guys, on the caps, make sure you're doing it. All caps question, and I'll do my best to get them as we go. Let's talk real quick. I want to end with some animals that will work well for this and why. Chicken. I think chicken is a great place for everybody to start. We eat more chickens than any other animal in this country. I just had this conversation with my grandson. He goes, we eat more chicken than any other meat? I said, well, maybe. I'm not sure. But I don't mean it that way. I mean, chickens are small and everybody eats it and they're cheap. So when you go to the grocery store, you have 3 primary proteins available, right? You have pork, beef, and chicken. Yeah, I know most people have lamb too, but in the end, when you look at the meat counter, what's out in the meat counter at the average grocery store is pork, beef, and chicken. The cheapest thing by price is probably chicken. The thing that's most appealing, what does every kid order off the kids' menu? Chicken nuggets, chicken strips, chicken fingers. People eat chicken, especially boneless. It's cheap. It's widely available. People are familiar with it. People are comfortable with it. I don't know many people, unless they have some sort of allergic reaction or metabolic condition or something, that don't eat chicken. So almost everybody eats it. People are familiar with it. You don't have to explain it. And almost everybody eats chicken's eggs. So you have two products and one animal that you can sell that people are comfortable with. It's also, we know exactly how to do it. And unless there's a specific prohibition against it, it's probably legal to raise chickens where you live. Some people are going to tell me, but it's not. Then you have to figure out what you want to do about that. I can't. So, like, there's a thing in permaculture we call the scale of permanence. And, like, a mountain is a 10. If you don't want to live in the shade of a mountain, don't buy a house in the shade of a mountain because you're not moving the mountain. Right? A 9 on the scale of permanence is a regulation or government-enforced code restriction. It's a 9. It's not as hard as the mountain, but it's damn close. So that's a very permanent issue to deal with. So you have to figure out how you're going to deal with that, either by designing in a way that they can't enforce it or hiding it or whatever. Yeah. But chickens are kind of where I would start for most people. Now, we do ducks, we have geese, but we don't really monetize the geese at all. They don't lay that many eggs. I only have a trio of geese. But we do really well with ducks as an egg producing animal. And if you live in an area with a large enough population, you may find that this is actually a really great niche to establish with. Most of our customers have some reason they don't want chicken eggs. Many of them have lived a lot of their life believing they couldn't eat eggs, but they like eggs. And when they try duck eggs, they can eat duck eggs and they can't eat chicken eggs. Also, many of our customers have determined, because they've eaten other people's duck eggs, that it's not the egg itself that's the problem. It's the soy in the feed, and they have a reaction to the phytoestrogens, which are just basically estrogens in the egg. And most poultry feed is soy-based. And when you feed an animal that's going to lay an egg a lot of soy, it will concentrate the phytoestrogens in the ovum, which is the egg, and the egg will be an estrogen bomb. I have confirmed this with scientific research by people that think that's a good thing. And it takes as little as 3 weeks to exponentially increase the isoflavones in an egg of feeding an animal. And it only takes about 10 days of not doing it for it to drastically drop. And it takes about 20 days for it to go back to the baseline. So even if you're already doing it, if you just come off it, then you have a soy-free egg. That is our customers care more about that than they do organic, regenerative, any other buzzword. Soy-free. Corn-free they care about, but soy-free, baby, that is the lick. And we've had people that said, you know, I thought I could eat duck eggs. Y'all were out or whatever. And I bought some from this guy on Craigslist, and I know enough about eggs. You can look at a duck egg and tell it's not a chicken egg. They were duck eggs. I still had my problems. And when I asked them, yes, they're feeding soy. So soy-free is another nice thing. Now, Somos is asking about meat when it comes to ducks. Duck is a niche product for meat. But that means unless you have an educated customer base, it may not be a great product to sell. Ducks also have a low meat yield to the carcass. I think it is one of the best eating things on the planet, but a duck breast is very flat to the body, even like a jumbo pekin. They take longer to raise to meat size than a chicken. They take more work to process. So I would only do meat ducks for myself, and I do that now as when I have to cull. Mostly we make duck sausage. I wouldn't go into that model unless I had, you know, enough people to warrant the meat run of ducks on a continuous basis or an annual basis or something like that, already saying I'll buy it. It's going to be way harder to do. And here's the reality. If you process chickens, And if you have some friends that are a little less switched on with doing their own stuff, but you at least part the bird out and you give it to someone, they're probably going to go home and cook it. You give them a duck, they'll be like, oh, thanks, man. I've always wanted to try a duck. 6 months later, hey, man, have you eaten that duck I gave you yet? Ah, it's still in the freezer. You see what I'm saying? Stick to things people know, at least as your lead product, and then you can educate them on other products. So chickens and then quail. This is the beauty of quail. Quail are quiet. Somebody asked if they're loud. They are not loud. Roos make this sound, and I'll do the best interpretation of it as I can, like that. It sounds like a random wild bird to Karen. And I would say only the person just over your fence would even really notice it, especially if you live in a place where people have bird feeders and shit. Everybody's gonna think it's some kind of bird, which it is. But only the roos make this noise, and they don't start making till about 5 or 6 weeks in general. By then, they're getting real close to being culled out for meat birds anyway. But you can process quail in 30 to 45 seconds a bird if you're not plucking them. And that means that the ease of, like, these are the birds that need to go into freezer bags and be, you know, taken to the office to sell to Bob, Tom, and Frank on Monday. You can do it so quick. No specialized equipment. You don't need a plucker. It is literally, I can do it with my bare hands. But the way I do it with my bare hands, I end up with leg quarters, which is basically thigh and drumstick, and breast. If I use shears, I get whole little birds, right? So they're kind of splayed out. You got a breast and a leg still attached. So it's all about how you want to present them to your customer, parted out or not, or even like, hey, you know what? Here's your breasts and here's your leg quarters, and it's two different products, but you only did one thing. That's how I would personally do it. And you might find some customers really like the little drumette leg thingies, and some of them really like the breasts. So that's okay, too. But you decide how much. I prefer to, like, do the same thing for everybody. I got 10 customers. They each get 6 birds. Here's a package of 12 leg quarters and 6 breasts. And everybody gets the same. That I want to simplify this if it's a side hustle. When you get into quail that are culls, in other words, you have your girls. They come up to egg-laying age. They go into their first molt. That is when to process them, and the molt is a very easy, timable thing. You know when it's going to happen based on the age of the bird. And so what you do is you have a group of new egg layers born about 7 weeks prior to that happening, brand new fresh egg layers, no disruption in supply. Your culls I would not sell. They're much tougher. They need a little bit more attention, and you're going to need to use shears when you process them. And if you want to process with a plucker your quail, by all means, just skin on, whatever, by all means, do it. I'm just saying you have the option of this, like, 30 to 45 seconds a bird, right? Just look, you know, look at your screen, watch 45 seconds go by 1, 45 seconds go by 2, 45 seconds go by 3, and that's if you're slow. And there's a lot of value in that speed. There's a lot more work to do in chickens, is what I'm saying. Rabbits, the beauty of a rabbit is that it can be fed almost for free or totally for free if you set yourself upright. The bad side of a rabbit, a lot less people eat rabbit than chicken. Now, that's not true in other countries. And let me explain to you the why. Why don't Americans eat much rabbit? Rabbit is delicious. It is very similar to chicken. The whole, it tastes like just like chicken. No, it doesn't. Though if I did it in some kind of prepared dish with certain seasonings and all and told you it was chicken and you didn't know any better, you'd probably believe it. If it was all cut up, you could see the individual cuts. But it's the reason people say it tastes like chicken, if you never had anything and I'm trying to explain what it tastes like, that's the best I can do. Okay? They are an incredibly healthy animal to eat. Even the government says rabbit meat is healthy. All right? So why don't we eat more? Because it doesn't have a classification at USDA that makes it something that somebody can produce, you know, 10,000 a month of and easily sell into the distribution system. The demand isn't there because the supply was never there to create the demand. It's that simple. Most Americans have never eaten rabbit in their life. I guarantee if you just now, if you out in the country, everybody hunts and you, dad shoots some cottontails every year. Even if the person doesn't eat it now, they probably remember eating when they were a kid. Like every person I knew growing up in high school had probably eaten rabbit at some point in their life because I just lived in, you know, Appalachia, central PA. First day of deer season is a school holiday, different situation. Go to any decent size, not even city, town, and do the walk around, you know, downtown area with a microphone. And can we ask you a couple of questions and say, have you ever eaten rabbit? I'm going to tell you 90% of people are going to tell you no. So the negative is you got to educate the consumer. That's why I wouldn't use it as a lead product. But maybe it's something if you get into it, you do just enough for yourself, and then you have existing customers, and you part a few bunnies out, and you give everybody like a saddle and a couple quarters or something and say, hey, go try it. And let me know. I'm interested in ramping this up too, like I do the other things, but I want to know you want. And if you get enough to come back and say, I'll buy X number from you, a quarter or something, then you ramp that up. But man, when I talk about leaning out efficiency, a bagging lawnmower, a cheap plywood put slap together hay baler for the winter and some fodder trees, and you can cut your rabbit feed bill to almost nothing. I always recommend having feed pellets for animals like this just to make sure you don't get in a bind. You don't ever want your animals stressed. And if you can also make some rabbit tractors and start tractoring your bunnies and you inform your market of what you're doing, always tell your story to your market, even if they know you. Like, and make sure they really know why it's important that you do what you do. These bunnies are finished on pasture. That's why I only have them available these months out of the year. They come in these groups. Average doe has this many babies. I have this many does. That means this is how much I'm going to make. They spend the beginning with their mommy in their little hutch, but then they finish out their last 3 weeks on grass. This makes them a much higher quality product. You can't even buy this in a store, and I'm selling it to you for what you get it for in a store if they happen to have some mass-produced shit there, which you're probably only going to find at Whole Foods or Central Market. If you can't sell that to your market, you don't want to bring that to your market. Like, if that's not enough to get them bought in, at least to try the product, don't do that as a profit product. Grow it only for yourself. But you also need to think about how what you're doing can make you money. So most of the people that I know that do rabbits sell very little meat. And they'll get maybe $15-$20 for a meat rabbit, but they can sell a breeder for $30 and all they gotta do is here's your rabbit. They don't have to even process it. And that's legal anywhere it's legal to have a rabbit. So you don't have to be in this space only for the space. You can use the space to branch out into other things. We're talking about meat today, but I don't see any reason that maybe you might not tell all your customers that also garden, hey, I grow these really cool sweet. This is true. I personally, Jack Spiracle, grow these really cool sweet potatoes every year. I have to make slips every year, and I sell slips for a bundle of 10 for $10 every year on Nextdoor. I started just to see if I could do it. I make, you know, $10 is $10. It's all profit. And I make 20 bunches, $200 a year. It covers all my fertilizer, my seed, everything for my gardening. I don't want to do any more than that. Well, if I was selling a meat product, I might make more of those. Or I might take all this manure and make fertility products for my customers. I might, and you might find that you have customers that they don't garden, but you know, they have rhododendrons and whatever, like, and they want their gardens, like their ornamentals to be beautiful. You could sell that person compost tea, et cetera. And you don't sell them a truckload of compost. You sell them a quart of compost with an instruction sheet of what to do with that quart of compost for $10. And when they use it the way you told them and they spray their rhododendrons and their azaleas or whatever, they're going to come back and they're going to want more. So you can build the business with the meat as the core and these other add-on products. But again, don't outgrow the ability to move the product. Other products you can look at, like, I don't want to talk about cattle at all today. They're too big, even for the person on a property my size. My property is so brittle, I wouldn't really try to do goats or sheep here, but there's a lot of people out there, 3, 4, 5 acres. They can do really well selling some meat goat or meat sheep. and also selling milk from those. And again, you have to know your local laws. So there's a lot of people in my area. You can find them again, Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist next door. They do goats. They sell goat milk. Technically in Texas, that's illegal raw milk, but they sell it as pet food. They sell it for making soap, whatever, right? But they also will say something like, knowing that the soap maker wants really fresh, high-quality goat's milk, ours is refrigerated immediately after harvest, and we harvest every week, and we take pre-orders. You know what they're doing. So does the Karen code enforcement officer. She doesn't have time to bother them. She doesn't really have a case, so she leaves them alone. Just be smart about it. Game birds might also be a niche I never thought of. ChatGPT came up with that one. Pheasant, you know, or some sort of, you know, like partridge or something. There might be a business model in that. I'm going to tell you, you really need to think about that, and you need to look at your local laws. If you wanted to raise pheasants in some states where pheasants are routinely hunted, it's a whole different permitting process. Some places, even where they're hunted, they don't give a fuck what you do. Some places, those extra regulations would apply to a ringneck pheasant, which is the only pheasant I know that has like wild sustaining populations introduced into the United States. But if it was something like a golden pheasant that they have down at the Fort Worth Zoo, that would be an exotic and there's no permitting process. In some places, it would be an exotic and that makes the permitting process higher. But it is something to look at, you know, and to think about, like, if you're doing these things anyway, is there a business there? Peacocks. There's people that are crazy about peafowl. I don't get it. I think the damn things are obnoxious and they make a lot of noise. But, you know, if there's people that make a good living on them. Guinea hens are not really a game bird. They're considered more of a farm bird. They're in a kind of a neutral area. Most places, if you can have a chicken, you have a guinea bird. But, you know, guinea fowl really are a game bird. It's hard to see that because most people in the United States have only seen guineas raised domestically, but there are a wild bird in Africa that is treated as a game bird over there. So that would be another niche. But, again, I caution you, when you go outside of what people are familiar with, it is better to have an established market that you can sample into and test it in a low-risk way to see if expanding into it makes sense. But I also want to say that I really think a lot of you guys that maybe will never do this and even will raise some food for yourself might need to look beyond your ability to produce for yourself to local producers. And I really feel that a lot of you may know somebody who's already doing it kind of part way, that if you were the marketing arm, and I mean a very minor job, and that if you talk to like friends and family in your circle, your common circle, and then you went to Bill and said, Bill, man, I know you're raising chickens, and I know some people that would want to buy chickens, and I've got five people right now that will commit to 10 birds apiece at $20 a bird for a bird averaging 4 to 5.5 pounds, if you'd want to do it for us. How can we help you get started? Bill's like, well, let me tell you what I need. And if you can help Bill get started, maybe even make it sort of like without the legal structure, co-op-ish in the beginning, like we'll all kick in an extra $50 for round one. We'll all invest in Bill so he can get the electronet and the charger, whatever it is that he needs. And if it doesn't work out, we're not going to get all butthurt about it. We're going to risk share. But then once we get Bill started, kind of like a locally organized Kickstarter, once Bill gets started, Bill has to fly on his own. Man, we could start producing producers. And just to be honest, folks, the reason I'm doing the show today, we're going to need this. Those things I started off with, you know, inflation and the cost of meat, the desire for quality, the raising awareness of chem-ag problems. Why do you think all of a sudden that the government's kind of allowing people to talk about it and not really fighting it as hard anymore about how bad chem-ag is for animals? because it's a war on me. So what they want you to do is realize I just can't afford meat, or I can only eat meat as a luxury and stay in their confined system. That's what they want. We have to adapt to this, or that's what it's going to be. You know, right now, many of you probably go to the grocery, you walk by the meat counter, and now you look at that, you know, that USDA prime, well-marbled ribeye behind the counter is nice and thick, and you go, just $19.99 a pound. I can't do it. And you go over and you find a cheaper cut that's, you know, cellophane wrapped, and you buy that. But you used to buy that ribeye. How long do you think it's going to be before, guess I'm eating chicken legs on Monday and Wednesday, and I really am going to have to, you know, just use leftover. Like, you're going to get there, you know, unless you're independently wealthy or something. I am going to tell you that I financially do very well for myself. I'm not rich or anything, but I make more money than some general practitioner doctors probably do. My house payment is exceedingly low because of when we bought, what our interest rates were, and how smart we buy houses, and how much equity we were able to roll into the new house. And I still now, when I go out and go shopping for food, go, how much? No. 5 years ago, I didn't blink. Well, that ribeye's $11 a pound, and it looks beautiful. Buy that fucker. Let's go home and cook it. If I'm thinking about it, I try to stay aware that I'm not where I always was. And I have conversations with my son as he's in his 30s and raising two kids and going through that struggle part of his life with, don't think that I wasn't doing it when you were that age. I just made sure you didn't know it. Because it's a lot of stress on a man trying to raise a family, you know? We all have been through that. But I haven't felt that way since that time. And now with what's going on, I do again. And I believe it's twofold. One, the entire fiat monetary system is coming unraveled in front of your face right now. You're looking at Weimar Germany. It's just not happening over 3 years. It's happening over 20. But the same net effect is occurring. And then the other side of it is there are people in power that they want everything funneled into block-sized commodity apportioned things that can be regulated and controlled, and they don't want a population that's healthy. They literally want a sick, compliant population. That's why it's getting easier to order a GLP-1 from HERS or for HIMS than it is to get a fucking decent piece of meat. That's why. Because they want you sick. That's why you constantly are bombarded with pharmaceutical commercials of fat people that are happy and active. If they were happy and active, they wouldn't be fat and they wouldn't be on fucking Ozempic. Ozempic's not the answer. You want the answer for your inflammation, your depression, right? The being out of shape, your high blood pressure, all of it. You want the answer. The answer is eat high quality, clean food. The end. And I'm not on my carnivore, ketovore fucking, soapbox right now. You want to eat potatoes and corn and all that other shit? I'm still going to tell you, get away from the fucking grains or put them in, like, you treat grains the way the government tells you to treat animal fats. They go a little tiny thing at the top of the pyramid, right? You want to have bread once a week or some shit? Go ahead. Make it yourself. You want to have bread every day? Go buy the book that's on my website. It's like in bread in 5 minutes a day or something like that, where you make the dough once a week and you cook the bread every day. You keep it in the refrigerator and it kind of changes and gets a little sourdough-like over the week. I put that there. Use organic grain and do that. I still think you're better off. Like, humans are not supposed to eat things that we can't put in our mouth and eat them the way that they come. If you pick up a sweet potato, it's kind of hard, but you can cut it with a friggin' knife and eat it raw. You will not get sick and you will not die. Go ahead. Eat fucking wheat without processing it. You'll choke to death on it. In the words of Mark Shepard, you are not a bird. You do not have a crop. You have a big liver. You're meant to eat meat. That's what you're designed to eat. But even if you're not going to make your diet meat-based, if it's going to be a more typical, what we think of as a healthy diet, which is, you know, your nice little pork chop or your 4 or 5 ounces of beef, if that's enough for you, and your broccoli and your rice pilaf, you need to eat the highest quality, non-contaminated, homemade food you can get. If it comes in a bag or a box, you probably shouldn't be eating it. And all you have to do is look at the change in the health of America over the last 50 years to see that I'm right when I tell you that. Because I've said this before, this is why I will not go full Ken Berry Nazi on what you eat. I grew up in a family, we ate a lot of potatoes and we ate a lot of wheat. We didn't eat a lot of wheat. Is like, you know, bulgur or something like that. But what I mean is, you know what a pierogi is? A pierogi is you make a pasta out of flour, wheat flour, and inside of it is mashed potato and cheddar cheese, and then you make this little cool little edge to it, and then it's boiled to cook it. And then if you really want it to be good, after they're boiled, you take a pan, you throw some butter in the pan, and you brown the outsides of that fucker, and oh my God, they're good. And I'm not going to say that my whole family looked like we were ripped and on the cover of like Muscle and Fitness or anything, but nobody was obese. But you know where that potato came from? My granddaddy's garden. The flour came from Center Supply in town, and it was grown by Amish people 50 miles away. The cheese, I don't know where the fuck that came from. My grandmother got that. But, you know, and the butter came from Artsy the Butcher, who drove a little vehicle, came to our house every Saturday. Artsy came, and my grandma bought beef and bacon and pork from him, right? She bought pork, and when I say pork, she bought pork chops and stuff like that. She bought bacon, she bought ham, etc. She bought beef from him. She bought eggs from him. When she stopped keeping chicken, she started picking up eggs from him, and he brought us that stuff. And so that was coming from local producers, probably mostly Amish. So how did we go from a time when people were eating this incredibly varied diet? Maybe it wasn't optimum. Maybe it was still too carb-centric because we were poor and that's what you'd eat. But what else did we live on? Deer. There wasn't a kid that I knew that didn't have a hunting license. I knew plenty of kids didn't hunt. They had a fucking license because their dad was like, when you're old enough, you're going to hunter safety, and that's another tag for the family. Hell, I'm sure the statute of limitations is up on this. I lost my license twice a year every year. Go back down to Center Supply, lost my license again, Bill. Oh, okay, here's another one. Because that way you could put the tag on it, you could get it home, and once it was in the freezer, that fucking report card, that shit never got filled out. No, you went and bought a new license, got a new tag, shot another deer. I put for my family as a teenager 3 deer in the freezer every year. That's about 40 pounds of boneless meat per deer, right? That's 120 pounds of meat per family member, right? Was going in that freezer because everybody did it. My little sister, I don't want to hunt. No one gives a shit, honey. You're going to hunter safety course. You're getting a license. Sleep in the back of the truck on the first day of deer season. Whoever shot the first deer, come on, honey. You just got a deer. And that's her deer. Like, this is how we live, and somehow we were really healthy. We lived on deer meat. We ate everything. My diet as a teenager was closer to a Native American's than an American's. Like, before people came here, we ate deer. We ate rabbit. And I'm not talking about ones you raise in a cage. We ate squirrel. We ate duck. We ate dove. We ate grouse. We ate pheasant. We ate trout, we ate bass, we ate bluegill. I guarantee you, when you opened our chest, and our chest freezer was big, when you opened it, probably at least half of what was in there was wild game, and probably 25% came from Artsy the Butcher, and maybe 25% came from the store, and everybody was healthy. The only person in my family that was really sick was my grandfather, and that's because he had black lung and drank and smoked himself to death on top of it, right? I mean, otherwise, like, we didn't have anybody on any kind of chronic medication or anything like that, no chronic physicians. Why? Because human beings tend to do better right? I know this is crazy talk here. We tend to do better when we eat human diets. You know what's not human diet? The shit in the grocery store. When you pick a bag of food up and you start reading it and you get past about four ingredients, there's too much shit in there that doesn't belong in there. Now, if it's like seasoning, it's like rosemary, thyme, garlic, I'll let you call all that seasoning and be one ingredient. I don't really care about that. Unless you might need to pay attention because if let's say you're allergic to oregano, you don't want that in there. But when you see dihydrolated, monothelated soy protein extract, that just fucking no. Okay? If it says soy, no. If it says corn syrup or high fructose corn syrup or corn sugar, no. That is not human food. If it says, you know, rapeseed oil, canola oil, just about any oil that comes from seeds, even sunflower oil, no. Safflower oil, no. Corn oil, no. How much corn do you think it takes to make that little bottle of corn oil? This is another thing. If that product could not exist in the marketplace without government subsidy, you probably shouldn't be buying it. Do you think a farmer could afford to grow enough corn to make that bottle of corn oil and sell it for $4 and make a profit if corn wasn't subsidized? You got to be out of your mind. It's insanity. It is an industrialized product and it does not belong. Industrialized food does not belong in feral humans, and you are a feral human. They're trying to domesticate you. How do you domesticate an animal? Do you feed it its wild diet? No. You feed it a processed diet. You make it weak and you make it compliant and you make it dependent. You take away its intrinsic characteristics that make it able to live in the wild, and then you selectively breed it into further compliance. And the way you start is you take it away from its mama so it can't learn to be a wild pig, and you feed it slop and you keep it in a pen and you make it as tame as a dog. And when you're done raising it and it's big enough, you shoot it in the fucking ear and you eat it. And the only way it doesn't get shot in the head and eaten is if it has another purpose that benefits you. If it's a cow, it better produce milk. It dries up, it's burger. It's a chicken, it better lay eggs, it stops making eggs, it goes in the crock pot. What do you think the industrial system that sees you as? You are fucking tax cattle. That's all you are. That's all you're good for. And that's why when you get old and they give you a little bit of your money back and they call it Social Security, it's just enough to get by on because, well, if we had a bunch of old livestock laying around dead on the edges of the farm, people might get wise to what we're doing here. You have to stop this shit. That's what this episode's about. It's not just a way to make some side money or find a place to get this food. It's understanding that if we don't start producing our own food and we keep eating what they're feeding us, they know they're killing us and they do not care. I don't even think they're doing it to kill us. I want you to look at it this way. Most people love their dogs. Most people love their dogs. And if they have a large dog or more than one large dog, man, they know Purina really isn't the way to go, but as far as they're concerned, they can't afford to feed that dog what that dog needs to really eat. There's also a corollary there that your veterinarian has done a really good job of saying what? No people food for the doggies. My vet told me that, not the one I have now. He's awesome. My old vet, she said that, and I said, really? What's people food? No one had ever fucking, her face went blank. It took a minute to compose herself. And I'm like, well, what do you suggest we give them for a treat? She said, oh, something like a carrot. And I said, really? Dogs are based on wolves and coyotes and dingoes and things like that. They come from the wild, right? That's why you say not to give them people food. She goes, well, yeah. I said, well, where would a dog get a fucking carrot in the woods or on a prairie or something? Where would a coyote find a carrot? What do coyotes eat? She's like, well, they mostly eat like rats and mice and rabbits and stuff like that. I said, well, then shouldn't we feed them like an analog to that, like chicken and beef and stuff like that? Well, yeah, that's okay. I said, isn't that people food? What she meant is don't be feeding them Doritos. She was right. She just had never been called on it, never really processed it before. So what is the fucking kibble made out of? The same shit they make Doritos out of with some bone meal and blood meal mixed in it. Maybe they shouldn't eat that either. But what do most people feed their dogs? Why? Because they can afford to. Do you think they do that? And it's like, fuck my dog. I don't give a shit about my dog. Screw my dog. I don't care what happens. They look at it and they say, well, if I'm going to own a dog, this is dog's food. This is what I can afford to feed him. I added a dog to my household, not another person. I can't feed the dog steak. How much of the industrial food system do you think bureaucrats just say, yeah, it would be great if we fed everybody really high quality food, but it's not doable. It is doable. But you have to do it for yourself. You're not a fucking dog. You're not a pet. But brother, sister, whatever applies to you, pick your pronouns if you must. That's how the government sees you. That's how, you know, Proctor Silux sees you. That's how Kellogg's sees you. You're a fucking animal to be harvested for a profit. And as long as what I'm doing is legal, then fine. I talked to a guy recently. He's also part of this. I like what he's trying to do. Okay. He's raising quail in a shipping container or something like that. But he has a patent. He has a patent on raising quail in a shipping container. And I'm like, man, if you really do, I'm out. And it turned out he had this broad patent. I'm like, you can't patent raising shit in a freaking shipping container. There's nothing, like, his lawyer said that he should be broad. I'm like, so you have legal justification for this. That doesn't make it right. I also don't think the business model is very viable. I don't think adding an $8,000 component to something that you can make for less than $8,000 in total is a valid business model. But I wish him well. I gave him some advice. Hope he does well. But just because you legally can do something does not make it ethical. But this is the mind of the bureaucrat and the corporate apparatus. How many of you have had jobs where you knew what you were doing is wrong, but you did it anyway because you knew you wouldn't get in trouble for it? And if you didn't do it, you'd lose your job. Now imagine you had real power, but you thought the same way. That's your food supply. Let's take a few questions and then we'll wrap up. Question one, how do you calculate fat content officially when grinding your own? I do it visually. I take the meat, and there's always some fat mixed in the meat, but I pretty much separate your lean and your fat, and I kind of look at it and go, that's about 80% of this is 20. Put them together. That's it. That's all I do. If you want to, you can weigh it. Just know that lean muscle weighs more than fat. So if you're doing it by weight, you're doing it by weight. If you're doing it by volume, you're doing it by... So you could measure it with a bowl, right? If you had a bowl and if you filled it all the way with lean, if you filled it about one-fifth with fat, you'd have about 80-20. But I just look at it. A builder of castles says, are pigeons noisy? It's, and they make that, so they sound like doves. Pigeons are a great meat bird too. They're actually raised, they're probably, I'm going to say the second or third most eaten protein in the world by people that don't go to the grocery store for their protein. I tell you what the number one protein is in the world like that, goat. But all through desert regions, there's this long tradition of raising pigeons in what they call dovecotes, and some of them are built right into the buildings that people live in. And so the thing about pigeons is once they're home, they'll always come back to the same place, and you can get them for free. I've actually thought about doing it, and I just never have. I had an uncle that raised pigeons. He raised them for a different reason I won't get into today. But we ate them all the time as well, and they produce a pretty good egg. And the main meat product of pigeon is squab. And what a squab is a baby pigeon that's almost an adult. They're only a little bit physically smaller, but they haven't fully feathered out, and they're really tender because they've never flown, because pigeons are a pretty tough bird. We used to shoot pigeons on the one farm we hunted doves on, and the pigeons would come in, and we'd shoot them too. And when you do a dove, you just basically rip the wings off and pop the breast out. You just take a freaking knife or a machete and cut the wings off of a pigeon. They're a bigger bird and they're a little bit tough. And the way we used to cook them is we'd throw them in the pressure cooker for about 10 minutes under pressure to tenderize them. And then we would either finish them in the oven or on the grill to give some color to the meat and what have you. Otherwise, you had to cook them like really slow cook them. So you want young birds out of pigeons, but they're definitely a really interesting animal to raise for meat. I don't know that they would be very marketable unless you had an educated market. Again, that would be one to kind of give it a shot and sample it out and see if anybody comes back for more. Are there any concerns raising pasture turkeys while wild turkeys live on the same property? Not for me. I wouldn't worry about it at all. I have a friend who says they cannot have poultry on their property due to their HOA. But their HOA is like, you know, these people that want to pretend they live in the country, but they don't really want to live in the country. You can have a horse, but not a cow. People, you can have wild turkeys running around, but you can't own chickens type place. I'm like, I don't know why you live there. He said my wife wanted it, and I wasn't thinking this way when we bought it. Okay, fine. He says they have wild turkeys on their property all the time. They can have a garden. They have to shoot the deer because the deer eat the whole garden. I told him, you have a deer garden. I don't know what your problem is. But I told him, I said, if you want to raise poultry, get turkeys that look like wild turkeys and just don't say nothing about it. And everybody will see them and go, oh, there's more wild turkeys. Well, those are some big ones, right? So I've never worried about that at all. There is the possibility that if you have wild birds around, you could get some interbreeding, especially a wild gobbler with your hens. If you don't have a big old robust gobbler to be like, no way, bitch, these are my hens, right? And you would want to make sure that you had a kind of a larger breed, because that will probably put an end to that. But I don't even think that would be that big of a problem. And you could always, if not, other than genetic testing, how would anybody know? But I'm not really worried about any disease exchange or anything like that. That wild bird is probably healthier than most domestic birds. Missile Launch says, basement Angus, yay or nay? I guess you're saying, can you raise cattle indoors? I wouldn't. If you're still here, you want to clarify that while I'm wrapping up, I'll do what I can for you. But I wouldn't try to raise cattle inside. A cow belongs outside in the sun on the grass. Question, do you think the water and food supply is aiding in turning the younger generations gay? I don't think it's making them gay. I do think it's making men less masculine. Most of the people we refer to as soy boys are heterosexual. I don't think there's really more gay people than there ever were. I do think there's a lot of people that want to play the game, and that seems more predisposed to women to me. I'm going to get some heat for this. I think there's a lot more women who lean bisexual than we know. I'll just say that. And as a man, I can understand, right? Women are beautiful. They smell nice. They're pretty. We're ugly. We stink. We're hairy. We're nasty, right? I can understand, right? But I think there is, when you make something cool, more people want to be part of it. And if that person has a predisposition and a mental illness, and if they are having problems and they're miserable and they feel like I'll belong to something if I do this, even if it's counter to what they really are, they'll participate in it. And, you know, you've seen this with behaviors that we know are evil, like mob mentality. People that would never steal anything all of a sudden are part of a flash mob robbing a store. It's not that all the people in that group are that way, but the people that instigated it lead these others into it. And I think there's some of that. But I think that when you start feeding people unnatural foods, the thing that gets disrupted first is hormonal processes. And if you do that during the key developmental years, which are about, let's say, 8 to 10, and then from there up until about in your early 20s, as you get not just physical maturity, but like maturity of the prefrontal cortex, you can mess some people up mentally really, really, really bad. And I think you could make men far less masculine, far more effeminate, far more soy-faced. I think that is a thing. How much of it goes all the way to gay, I don't know. I don't spend a whole lot of time figuring out how many gay people there are. But I think in general, gay men make up maybe 2 to 5% of the population of males. I don't think that we have any more of that than we ever did. We have more visibility, so it looks like a lot more. And then we have a lot of people that they're not gay, but you think they are. You know, I don't know how to put it any other way, like what have you. But I definitely think, like, one of the biggest reasons that we have so much obesity is hormonal disruption. Take two 10-year-olds, or let's say 8-year-olds, that are the same height and about the same width in the shoulders, a female and a male, that aren't fat, healthy young people. Put them in a place where all you can see is a silhouette and look at them from behind. And if the girl has hair, you know, like, bind the hair up so they have the same look. And if you say to somebody, which one of those is the male and which one is the female? If they're right, it's because a coin flips right 50% of the time. If you flip a coin 100 times, you're going to get heads about 50 times. Take them to the age of 18, same height. Do the same thing with the hair. Because, you know, get a bit taller of a female, a bit shorter of a male. Same relatively basic body weight. Like, you don't really want a super frail guy or a super heavy girl. So the girl's going to weigh a little bit less in that same height. But don't look for the dude that's, like, jacked, that's been in the gym every day. And don't look for the chick that's, like, had a breast job and an ass implant job when she was 16 years old. Just standard kind of, and you say to a normal person, which one's the girl and which one's the boy? That one, and they'll be right 99% of the time. Well, what did that? What put the extra fat cells on the breasts that are showing, kind of poking out of the side a little bit? What created that kind of slimmed waist and a little bit broader hips? What created those broader shoulders in the male? And that, you know, the male's kind of shaped more V-like and the female more hourglass shaped. Turn them sideways and anybody with a brain can figure it out, even a small-breasted female. That's a chick. That's a dude. Do it now and you're like, I don't know, they're both look like, that's kind of a pudgy fat chick and better looking chick. And the pudgy fat chick is a dude with moves at 18. What did that? Hormones. Hormones did that. What fucks up the hormones? The food supply. I'm sorry, there's no way around it. I got one more and I got to close up. Comment from Angie. You do have to watch blackhead in turkeys where chickens have been, currently are. It's easy to fix with dewormer, but it takes a hot minute to figure out what you have. I'm not familiar with that. I never had that problem. I've cohabitated chickens and turkeys. Maybe Angie's talking about wild birds. If you want to shoot me an email, Angie, with any additional information on that, because I'd like to actually cover it and do a little research on it. John, real quick here, has thrown me a 5-pound super chat. Thank you, man. He says, thanks for all you do, Jack. Question, I'm in the UK anyway. I can get some of your deals here. Probably not. Now, almost everything that I put out that's an Amazon product, like the one I'm about to show you, it's probably on Amazon UK. I don't think we get paid for Amazon UK anymore. We used to, but I don't care. I put out the information to put out the information, and I take the affiliate commission that comes from doing that. We used to have a deal with Amazon UK. There was some shit we had to do to our website to make that continue, and I just discontinued our participation in that plan with some EU compliance bullshit. I'm like, it's not worth it. I make like $100 a year off it. But if you mean like the discounts from MSB, most of my MSB vendors are 100% US or at best North America. So sorry, I can't do anything about that. But thank you for that. And that means the international MSB members I have. Guys, thank you so much, because I know you know that. And I know some of you do it anyway. And I really tried to make the MSB something that benefited people. So thank you for those of you who choose to do it, even though you know you won't have, you know, there might be a few things you can do, but a lot of things you can't. All right, real quick, I do have an item of the day, and I forgot to tell you about it yesterday. These are called Stabilizers, slip-on ice cleats. And, you know, I do actually own everything I recommend, so I have some of them right here for those that are on the video anyway. And all they are is like a rubber thing that slips over your shoe, and on the bottom of them, they have little metal cleats. And the pair that I'm showing you now, we don't use them that much because of my climate, but these are more than 10 years old. And I used them just the other day because we had ice everywhere. I had to take the cat out on Saturday to the vet. There was ice all over the driveway and things like that. And it takes one fall to really hurt you. Let me tell you when these came into our lives. We used to use something very similar to this when I lived in Pennsylvania. And we moved down here. It just became, you deal with the ice a few times a year. right when I first moved in this house, I had an intern. Some of you will remember Josiah. Remember the Josiah years? Well, we were going out. His mom was here. So instead of making him get the gate, I went to get the gate. We have a pretty good depression right in front of our gate. It had snowed and it looked like it was all snow. Well, some of it had melted and settled underneath, and then we had snow on top of ice. So I go walking my happy ass over there to open the gate. Boom. Straight up, because you're not, when you don't know it's there, it's the worst, right? Straight onto my back. Martial arts training kicks in. Chin tucks to the chest. Two arms slap down, and I executed it perfectly. I still cracked the shit out of my head. Because it was so much force that even doing that, it drove my head back, and it was like a bone. It didn't crack, but it felt like a bone cracking smack of my head to the ice. I was totally conscious. My bell was rung, and I just laid there for a second to get my bearings and to, like, I'm going to, like, not flip out, not go postal, like, one of those moments. To everybody looking at it, I was unconscious. So then I hear footfalls. Josiah, who's like a 270-pound dude, I'm coming to help you. Like, roll over, like, no, because all I can see is his ass falling to and landing on top of me. I waved him off. I got up. We got the gate open. And we went and did our shit. We came home, and I found these. And these, when there is ice on the ground, and I go out and I do work, I slide these over my shoes or my boots. I highly recommend that you do too. And let me tell you, had I not had that training in my background, and had I gone back like most people do, I may have ended up in the hospital or, like, I don't know, like, eating off a spoon somebody feeding me from that injury alone. I've seen major injuries to people's knees and ankles from this. And as we get older, a fall is more serious. Andy McCann says, once you're over 65, if you have a significant fall, your odds of dying in the next couple of years goes up by like 60%. We all know old people have broken legs, broken hips, things like that. We just don't need falls. I also want to tell you, a lot of you guys are younger, and I'm the man, and I'm tough, and blah, 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 blah. And yeah, when you bust your ass and you're laid up and your wife has to take care of everything, are you being a good provider? Guys, these things are $20. It's winter time. If you don't own something like this, get these. You're a prepper. How about be prepared not to fuck yourself up? I'm telling you, get yourself a pair. And if you live up north where you have to deal with it more and you don't have something like this, the company that makes those, they have a whole bunch of different things. Some of them are higher quality product for people that maybe would ice fish or something like that. But, bro, this, yeah, Homestead Glamour says this would make a great Christmas gift. Yeah, I wish I would have. These are one of those things that have so become integrated into our life. I don't even think about them. These should have been on T-Spaz when I started T-Spaz. And I just didn't do it because I never, you know, again, I pull these out 2 or 3 times a year. But I am never going to end up with my knee fucked up, my head cracked, my ankle broken because of ice. Because I don't have to, because I took this one step. And I really recommend you consider it as well. With that, I'll wrap up today. Thank you to everybody here. Liberty Cast threw me another super chat. This is a great super chat day. $4.99 super chat. Thank you so much for that. Everybody that was here, thank you. I will catch you tomorrow with an interview. And since my granddaughter, before they left, brought me my interview sheet for tomorrow, I can tell you that we're going to be talking to Matthew Trum tomorrow, and we're going to be talking about megafires from a permaculture perspective. This is very timely. And I'll tell you that the fires that we're dealing with in California, when this application came in, had not yet occurred. This application came in right after Thanksgiving, and we're just now getting that booking on the air. So this will be good. I wanted to talk about this anyway. I think the only solution for California involves a lot of earthworks. And I'll leave it at that, and we'll cover that tomorrow. So that'll be our live stream tomorrow. And again, we're back to our regularly scheduled programming. Have a great day, everyone. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.